Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and this week we're sharing some of our favorite songs about photography and talking with ace photographer Marty Perez. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kot. But first, we have to pay tribute to David Crosby.
And it appears to be a love poem. Appears to be a love poem. Appears to be a love poem.
It's a long, 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 long time before the dawn.
That is a little bit of a long time gone from the Crosby, Stills, and Nash self-titled 1969 debut album, one of the biggest selling albums of the 60s. One David Crosby singing harmony vocals on that and wrote that particular song. David, as many of you already know, died January 19th at age 81, a massive figure in popular music, really helped self-create that sort of Laurel Canyon, California scene, first with the Byrds and then with Crosby, Stills, and Nash, and then Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young. What a run. Most people could say that and end their career after those three bands
over the course of
8 years,
if
right?
If all he had on his CV is that he wrote 8 Miles High for the Byrds,
Oh my God,
what a song.
Well, not only that, I mean, McGuinn gets a lot of props, Roger McGuinn.
Yeah.
His partner in the Byrds gets a lot of credit for the solo and the jazzy, 12-string guitar drone. But you look at what Crosby's doing on rhythm guitar against what McGuinn is playing. It really makes the song in many ways.
Well, and Crosby, Greg, you know, I dug deep into his history. I interviewed him. I read his two autobiographies. He was the link to both world music for many of the 60s bands and psychedelia, right?
Mm-hmm.
Indulging prolifically. But he had done time. Did you know this? In Les Baxter's Balladeers?
Yeah.
Which was part of the Martin Denny Space Age Bachelor Pad Lounge music exotica scene. And that is where he first heard the sitar. Mm-hmm. And he brought it into that crowd, which before George Harrison got to it, you know. So elements of that, he was a very Zelig-like character.
He was. He connected a lot of scenes, you know. He would do things like, teach the Grateful Dead how to sing harmonies before they made Working Man's Dead.
Working Man's Dead, American Beauty. He's all over the harmonies on that.
Credits that. Brought Joni Mitchell in, you know, brought her to a higher plane. You know, he basically admits, I screwed up her first album. But, he kind of got her into that sort of scene in the first place. And she does credit him with sort of elevating what she was doing.
Many, many people credit Crosby and also say he could be intolerable.
He's a pain in the butt.
Cantankerous, horribly grouchy. At one point, he was on the outs with all the other members of CSNNY. And he had regrets about that. But he could be difficult, but he could also be brilliant. He hated punk rock. He has some notorious quotes out there. About basically, he hated anything that he wasn't part of.
Yeah, right. It should be mentioned that he had a great final few years where he was just like, he could see the end coming And he goes, I'm just going to get as much work done as I possibly can, sort of recovering from a very difficult middle age period where he was going through all these addictions. But, you know, I want to focus on the fact that he had this amazing run, and he did tend to piss people off.
Yeah.
But at the same time, he pushed these bands into areas where they didn't necessarily want to go. He wrote that beautiful song Triad for the Birds, and they said, no, we're not going to touch this song about a menage a trois, you know?
But Jefferson Airplane did it, wound up with CSN.
They did. And I mean, these songs, Wooden Ships, Deja Vu, the title track of the Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young record, Laughing from his first solo record.
Yeah.
These are songs that still to this day hold up because they were very unconventional art pop songs. You know, he was really kind of pushing out the margins in terms of genre before some of these bands and collaborators were ready to do the
same. Well, and consistently railing against the man, to use the 60s lingo. On the other hand, I had an interview with Crosby where CSN was touring and the tickets were in the stratosphere, you know, a couple of $100, $500, $600.
Yeah.
You know, and I asked him about that, and he just took my head off.
Mm-hmm.
I have the right to charge whatever I want. And I'm thinking, that doesn't quite jibe with Let's Get Back into the Garden.
No, I asked him about the ticket prices too, and he hung up on me. He wasn't pleased about that question. But you know, I also think the guy was a wild card in the best possible way. You know, everybody knows that Neil Young wrote Ohio.
Yeah,
great song. You know, commenting on the Nixon era, the shootings at Kent State, motivated Devo, as we know, to form a band. But at the same time, Crosby singing How Many More, Why,
at the
end of that song,
his emotional breakdown
at
the end. Yeah.
That is just shattering part of that song. And Crosby brought that element to everything he did. I want to play a little bit of some of Cowboy Movie from his first solo album, If I Could Only Remember My Name. First of all, one of the great album titles of all time. Secondly, one of the great album covers of all time.
Yeah.
The image on that album of that sun, I guess it's a sunset, and over his face. It's just an incredible image. But the whole album is amazing, and it got destroyed when it came out, critically destroyed. And now people are listening to it. This is an amazing record. It's just a mystical kind of journey that he's taking in these songs that I think to this day sounds haunting, mesmerizing, you name it. Here's a little bit of Crosby, Cowboy Movie on Sound Opinions. That is David Crosby with Cowboy Movie from If I Could Only Remember My Name, his first solo album in, I guess it was 1970, 71.
Mm.
Amazing record to this day. I highly recommend people seeking it out. We wonder if you, our listeners, have any thoughts about David Crosby. Were you a fan, or did his prickly personality turn you off? It did many others. Let us know in our Patreon community or leave us a voice message on our website, soundopinions.org, so we can play it on the show. Now, let's turn to some songs about photography.
Yes, Greg, you know, we are an audio medium. We do not have a visual component, thank God. But it is fun to talk about rock photography, especially on the occasion of our old pal, Marty Perez, putting together his first book, which spans a lifetime, really, in music photography, and which got us thinking about how often we come across songs about pictures, cameras, photography, the whole shebang. There are tons, right? So we're going to first play a few of our favorites, and then we will chat with Marty Perez, and then play a few more songs. Why don't you lead us off?
Thanks, Jim. I will. I want to go with Spoon's I Turn My Camera On from their 2005 album, Gimme Fiction. There's different ways of angles of looking at cameras and photography. We're going to try to do that when we pick these songs. Britt Daniel, I talked to him about this song years ago. I love the song. He's doing his Prince thing on that song with the falsetto vocals, a little bit of a soul vibe for Spoon, which they don't often do, but they do it well when they do it. This is an example of that. You know, he's talking about the camera as an emotional distancing device. You know, the song is about a relationship and how it can grow apart and how it can difficulty gelling with people. But with a camera in front of your face, you're obscuring your face. You're sort of engaging in with the world at arm's length. You're documenting it, but not necessarily participating in it. So I thought it was a really apt metaphor for the way relationships sometimes work. Mm. Here's a little bit of I Turn My Camera On from Spoon on Sound Opinions.
I turn my camera on, I cut my fingers on the way of slipping away. I turn my feelings on, you made me untouchable for life. Yeah, yeah, and you wasn't alone. It hit me like a ton. You hit me like a ton.
That is Spoon with I Turn My Camera On. Jim, you've got a photography song for us next.
I do. I'm going to start with my strangest, Greg. Into the Lens, parens, I Am a Camera by Yes. Mm-hmm. Why I say it's strange. 1980, you know, post-New Wave. Yes is falling apart. John Anderson, the vocalist who we've talked to on the show, is gone. Who does Yes bring in to complete the band? Trevor Horn and Jeff Downes, a.k.a. The Buggles.
Right.
Video killed the radio star. Jeff Downes, a brilliant multi-instrumentalist who would stay with Yes for some time. Trevor Horn, filling in for John Anderson. How strange. They had this song kicking around. The Buggles would later release it. But the idea of I am a camera, I am recording all that is in front of me. Interestingly, on the Buggles version, it's credited just to Horn, who'd become a super producer, and Downes. But Yes, you know, being Yes, all the members of Yes take credit because they're all soloing and being Yes. Mm-hmm. I saw Yes for the first time as a kid at this point, and it was strange, you know, seeing those two Buggles and then the guys in Yes, you know, the 25, 30-year age difference and very different aesthetics. But you know, the Drama album, I think, holds up. And I love this song, Into the Lens, I Am a Camera by Yes.
I am a camera.
That's a weird one, huh, Greg?
It is, but I expected nothing less from you, Mr. Dear Goddess.
Well, we try to dig deep on these shows.
Absolutely. You know, Pink is one of my favorite artists. I guess some people may be taken aback by that, but I think she's a wonderful songwriter. It was the first concert my oldest daughter and I attended together, so I have fond memories of that. She was coming up at that time. It was, I think, her first tour. And I've sort of followed her ever since. I think she gives a great show, and she writes some very good songs that are try to go several levels deeper than the typical pop song does. The song Family Portrait from her 2001 album Misunderstood talks about the idea of what a portrait is. Mm. You know, this is written from a child's perspective. I assume that the young Alicia Hart, later known as Pink, was drawing from her personal experiences with her family. Her parents divorced at an early age, and this is about the trauma that can cause for a child and her brother at the time. The word has a double meaning. I mean, the portrait that, you know, that's the family picture on the nightstand, but it's also, in this case, a portrait of, in words, of what her family's life was like back then, and it's not... It's not a pretty picture, to put it mildly. Family Portrait from Pink on Sound Opinions.
Oh,
That is Pink, Alicia Hart, talking about her childhood trauma in Family Portrait.
You're right, Greg, a really solid songwriter and an inspiring person. From that obscure Yes ditty that I started out with, I'm going to go to a real obvious one. Photograph by Ringo Starr. You know, I love Ringo. I love this song. You know, I just recently was raving about the new box set of the Revolver album and, you know, Ringo's performance on Rain and so many of those great drum tracks. But, you know, this is a very emotional song about lost love, with the singer having only a single picture to remember this love that left his life. You know, that contrasts so wildly with the story of how it was written. Ringo and George Harrison started writing it together on a luxury yacht in the south of France in May 71. Ringo had hired the yacht. He was starting his acting career. He was going to the Cannes Film Festival. Then they were hopping over to Mick Jagger's latest wedding in Saint-Tropez and wrapping it all up with the Monaco Grand Prix. You know, Ringo was living large.
Just that, man.
Okay. And, you know, to be able still to connect with the forlorn adolescent loss of this song,
right,
you know, it so effectively. It is, you know, I have always wondered whether Ringo, whether the hangdog kind of act was thrust upon Ringo. You know, George the mystic, Paul the cute one, John the intellectual and the wise ass, you know, and Ringo, you know, he only got by with a little help from his friends, right? Now, was this the band foisting that on poor Mr. Starkey, or was, you know, or was that actually him? You know, my interview with him that I did one, you know, you can't really tell, you know, fact and fiction, who he really is versus, you know, chronically underrated. It was a great chat I'd had because I understood his drumming, you know, and we could talk about the rim shots and the fills and, you know, but I don't know. But anyway, this is the archetypal in many ways Ringo song right after I Get By With a Little Help From My Friends. Photograph. Gotta love that, Greg. That is a great song. Photograph by Ringo Starr and George Harrison. And man, you know, Ringo, so much love from the musical community. You know who's playing on that song? Nicky Hopkins, Bobby Keys, the great drummer Jim Keltner, and Phil Spector's musical arranger Jack Nietzsche. You know, it's like, holy cow. And Harrison, you know.
Everybody wanted to be in a room with a Beatle, right?
You know, Ringo calls, you say, sure, what time? I'll be there. Those are a few of our favorite songs about photography. We're going to have more later in the show. But we would love to know your favorites about this subject. Please share it with us in a voice message on our website, soundopinions.org. Coming up, we're going to talk with photographer Marty Perez about the craft of rock photography. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions.
This is a photograph, a window to the past of your father.
Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island has been brewing award-winning beers in Chicago that are inspired by this city. Take 312 Lemonade Shandy, Tropical Beer Hug Double IPA, and a rotating series of hazy IPAs only available in Chicago. You know, every time we go down to Goose Island, there's another one that they're pushing on us.
That's right.
They're all good.
Absolutely. And what supporters of musical culture, you know, in the city of Chicago and elsewhere, if you go to a show in Chicago and you see that Goose Island sign, you know you're in good hands. They're music fans as well as great beer makers at Goose Island, so we're really proud to be associated with them.
The Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer.
Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island's been brewing beers in the spirit of Chicago.
You can find IPAs, Lemonade Shandy, and limited releases in-store or at one of Goose's venues in Chicago. Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer. And we are back. You know, Greg, there are certain topics that are not usually great for the audio medium, as I said earlier. Painting, sculpture, and still photography don't always lend themselves to hearing us talk about them rather than looking at them, right? Dancing about architecture is the cliche about our entire profession. But today, we're going to make an exception to all that because our longtime friend and colleague, Marty Perez, has just released his first book of music photography, spanning an entire lifetime, spanning 40 years of the history of this music, Kill a Punk for Rock and Roll. One of Marty's most famous photographs as a kid, wearing that shirt. Looking at Marty as Marty takes his picture. We've both worked with him throughout our newspaper careers. He's taken some sound opinions pictures. There are many good reasons to go to a show with Marty because he's great company. He's a brilliant photographer. But also, Marty is no small individual. So many a rough mosh pit and dangerous show, I was taking shelter behind Mr. Marty Perez.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, he was a big-bodied dude, and he is still to this day, which is a great thing because people would bounce off him in the mosh pit. You know,
yeah.
It was like, you know, you can't move this guy. I'm working.
Well, and he's a
and
gentle giant.
Yeah.
You know, when someone would some meeker person would stumble in and get knocked over, Marty would pick them up physically and move them to safety.
No, he was a fan and first and foremost, and he took it from a perspective of somebody who understood what pictures he was taking. It was like he appreciated everything about it. There's one picture in the book which really stands out for me because I was at that show. It was a show at a Lounge Acts, a club here in Chicago, and it was one of Liz Phair's first bigger shows where people are starting to recognize.
Big, 150 people cramming into Lounge Acts,
And there was like a little walkway. Remember, Jim, down to the downstairs?
Yeah.
You know, and there was like a little place, you know, walkway to the side of the stage.
Yeah.
So Marty, smartly, instead of positioning himself in front of the stage like almost every rock photographer would do, so goes down this whole little hall, you know, this little walkway, and he's sort of behind the stage so he can see the audience reacting to Liz. And there's this great moment where Liz turns, she's literally amazed by the response the songs are getting. Like, she's made it. Like,
well,
people are appreciating it.
And scared to death.
Yeah.
Liz was
the
always
look in her eyes.
A trepidatious performer.
It was,
you know.
It was an incredible moment. And, you know, he just because he was not in the traditional spot where
he
most people are, he got the shot.
Well, it is a joy to welcome Marty to Sound Opinions. Marty, thanks for coming on the show.
No problem.
You know, we want to talk about the book and your career because it's a great story and you are a self-effacing fellow who doesn't even like to tell the story. What drew you to photography as a junior in high school on the south side of Chicago, right?
Yeah. I would see my dad taking around his camera on family outings or trips. And then back in those days, every 4 months, you know, the family would sit down after a Sunday dinner and be forced to watch slideshows.
Slideshow.
Yeah. You know, with that, it's like I was intrigued and said, let me take a look through the viewfinder, would start snapping. Next thing I know, I was given an Instamatic. When I went to my first concert, it was like, bring the camera with you and see what happens. And from there, it just was a constant companion.
Yeah, yeah. Who were some of your heroes? Were you looking up to, because I'll say this, because you never do. The book is called Kill a Punk for Rock and Roll. And that photo of this incredibly grungy band of bros giving devil's horns and holding up a T-shirt, Kill a Punk for Rock and Roll. I'd say, you know, Marty, that's a shot as famous in our alternative underground indie world as, like, you name the greatest, Bob Gruen's shot of John Lennon with the New York City T-shirt, or some of the Zeppelin shots that Neil Preston took. Were you admiring those guys, giants in the world
definitely.
Of rock
photos?
Oh,
without a doubt. And then, you know, Miss Annie Leibovitz.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
There's one book that came out, one of the earliest books, called The Art of Rock Photography, which was one of the first books that compiled a lot of the other photographers in addition to Bob Groin and a lot of the other photographers that had been starting the rock photography back in the days of, like, let's say, Bill Haley and all that.
When things
really didn't start grabbing people's attention until, you know, Jerry Lee Lewis and on for photography. Mm-hmm. And then you had the whole new audience of young people and press where Rolling Stone began to fill that void.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's fascinating, too, because these photographers were in an era when there was a lot of mystery around what do these bands look like. It was pre-internet, obviously, pre-MTV. Your band would show up and you'd be shocked at what they looked like because you had an image in your mind of what they would be like. And then you saw them in the flesh and you go, that's not at all what I expected. So the photography was critical to sort of spreading the word and communicating what the music was like. I mean, certain images are so indelibly entwined with the way the music was presented, you know, that you can't separate the two.
Do you think you have shots that rank like that, Marty? Because I do.
Well, you already said it. I the cover shot has been following me or has been with me since 1981. Kill a Punk for Rock and Roll. That was just one of those magic moments. Even at the moment when those kids kind of like poked me and said, hey, take our picture and stuff like this, I walked away there thinking, wow, after developing the role of film and seeing that one image, it always stuck with me.
What concert was that at, Marty?
That was Black Sabbath, I believe, Black and Blue. It was when
Ronnie James Dio. A good album.
Yeah.
And they were like, you know, the heck with this punk rock crap. Let's listen to real rock and roll, like Sabbath.
Yep.
That's classic.
Remember, right around that time, you know, and shortly after the first wave of punk, everything was marketed as punk rock. You had AC/DC, Tom Petty, and all that. And that was right around that time. Took a little while, but somewhere along the line, I've heard that it was Motorhead that reunited the two camps, and
that argument can be made. Yeah,
made them see the light that we're all in this together.
You are always front and center at the stage, surrounded by, given the music that you love, moshers, slam dancers. You know, you're getting spit at, hit on, knocked over, beer spilled everywhere. You know, and then front and center there is Marty.
He's an NFL linebacker in the middle of that, so he can handle it.
But I've seen even Marty tossed around at some shows.
No, there was a fireside show where, what was it, Los Crudos. I was literally picked up and moved 8 feet to the side of the stage.
Fireside Bowl, a famous punk rock venue down on its luck, bowling alley that was turned into a venue.
Well, part of the ethos, too, of that whole scene, and by scene, I guess I mean underground music, punk, was the fans are just as important as the bands. And the band, you could have easily switched places with the two. The fans were the band, and the band could have been the fans. And you documented that, too. It wasn't just about people on stage, right?
That's what I love about this book. There's as many pictures of the fans as there are the musicians.
When you're in the middle of them, and the band kind of begins to get old or goes into a slow number, it behooves the photographer to take a look around and see who's with you in there. And that was part and parcel of growing up in photography and appreciating and learning documentary and documenting your fellow man.
Yeah, which is really cool because I think that was the whole idea of the community. You didn't see that too often, you know, as photography became, if you went to a show and you came back with a bunch of photos of the audience, your editor, you know, on a big time publication would say, what is this? Why are you giving me these? I need a shot of Robert Plant, not of the person in the front row screaming to Robert Plant, right? You know? But
and then also, I think as early as the late 80s, took hold in the 90s, and it's been going ever since. Whenever you go to shoot a band nowadays, it's three songs and you're out.
Yeah.
If you're there shooting on assignment, you don't have the time to breathe and take a look around you. You're there for that. You're there to get the shot of, you know, the band. And back in the analog days of film, you only had 36 exposures and maybe be lucky to shoot off another roll. But the film you had and time constraint and rules of regulations really worked against it.
Well, and now this insidious policy of some bands, even ones that you would think should know better, like a U2, demanding the photographers have their work approved by the band before it's published.
Mm.
And we're talking overnight reviews in newspapers.
I didn't realize that. Oh, no.
Yeah, ouch. Yeah, no. Like, and it's a policy, Greg. I know the Tribune didn't abide by.
We never signed any. I mean, there were contracts put in front of our photographers all the time, and we never signed them. We said, okay, we're just not going to shoot your show then.
Yeah, which is why you began to see a lot less overnight photos of important events.
Right.
That is ridiculous and insulting to the photographer / the media and just who's a fan of rock and roll.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think the way photographers are treated like a nuisance, I noticed that, I obviously worked with a lot of photographers at the Chicago Tribune, and I work with you, Marty. You put, a lot of your photos for the Wilco book that I did are yours, which I appreciate to this day. But the point being that, it pained me to see photographers treated the way they were. More and more by management, by bands, by venues, because they were viewed as sort of a nuisance, get out of our way, when they were just doing their job. It no longer became part and parcel of documenting the event. It was more like, when do we get rid of these people, Why do you think that attitude shifted? Did you notice that shift, or was it just sort of a gradual thing? Or
I think that attitude's always been there. To survive, you kind of like have to be either dumb, a masochist, and have thick skin, or a combination of all the above. The photographer, Jim Marshall, he always complained about the lack of respect and the lack of payment, and just the rock photographer's always been looked upon as the black sheep of the whole thing, except when they, when somebody needs an album cover or used to need a promotional photo. Nowadays, that type of stuff is dead. Everybody's got their smartphone, so promo photos are done with smartphone or something, it seems like.
The ability to just control, click, and save a photo and then put it on your blog, put it in your publication, it seems like photographers' rights have been absolutely trampled. I remember talking to Bob Gruitt about that. I was buying pictures for my Lester Bangs book, and he was just sick to his stomach that so many of his famous shots had been appropriated for free. Mm. At that moment, U2 was doing a world tour, playing to 40,000 people a night, and they were flashing his John Lennon, I Love New York City, and he didn't even know that, much less had he been paid for it. Yeah. They didn't even have the courtesy to ask him.
Yeah.
No.
Have you seen your photos pop up in places where you're like...
Yeah, that's happened. That's happened. Or, the other thing is somebody decides to, they like the photo, and next thing you do is you see it on a subway poster from Europe or something, and by then it's 3 months down the line, and that particular project has been done, so that there is no budget, and you're too late, sorry, see you later, but take a copy of the record.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah,
And unfortunately, that appropriation is just comes part and parcel with the with photography. Not only rock photography, but any type of photography.
Mm-hmm. Has the fact that everybody has a cell phone now and is videotaping and photographing the shows that you're at, has that diminished the value of your work?
I guess that's a fair way to put it. I never thought I'd live long enough to see what I love doing become irrelevant or become shoved to the side and taken for granted. What's that video killed the radio star while the smartphone killed?
Yeah.
All right, so I promised a philosophical question, Marty. It's what I wrote about in my introduction. It seems to me that many rock photographers see their job as portraying the people on stage as golden gods, to use the famous Robert Plant, bigger than life, beautiful, perfection incarnate, right? Whereas you down in the pit, sweating along with the fans, I'm not saying you don't make the bands look good. I'm saying that you capture a reality in the moment that I have always found missing in too much rock photography. Did you agree with what I wrote? You capture people and soul and not, stars.
No, I appreciate that, and that's that was part of growing up and admiring and hearing what people like Patti Smith or Joe Strummer and the guys from The Clash would say in interviews. And you know, it was this new group of people weren't too different to myself, and if I had 2 cents and can contribute, I'm running with it.
Mm.
You know, for a lot of photographers, that those were the shots that a lot of these magazines and the public wanted to see, was the golden god. And that's another reason why you had that 3-song limit. Supposedly, you know, the performers didn't like to see themselves sweat or see the pit stains on their shirts and stuff like that, which kind of like bothered me, because you're up there for an hour and a half, 3 hours, you're sweating just like the rest of us.
It would have been like kicking a writer out after three songs. You got to review the show, and because they can choreograph those 3 songs and make sure that they look their absolute best, and the staging lighting is perfect. And
one example of that was just mind-boggling was being assigned to go see a Prince show. The first 3 songs was backlit or total dark.
Mm-hmm.
Once the photographers were ushered out of the pit, the place lit up like a Christmas tree. And Prince was notorious for having a disdain for his photographers. But it's like, you know, you kind of like need us to get your image out and to keep your train rolling down the line.
Yeah, the one thing I think Prince was big on the mystery. That's why he didn't do interviews either for a long time, right?
Right.
So he wanted to preserve that sense of, you know, who is this guy? You know, what does he look like? He was, you know, and it was a double-edged sword, because obviously, it caused some friction with everybody who was trying to cover him in a way that, you know, could help explain Prince to people. But I'm curious, though, Marty, I want to hear the 3 artists that you most enjoyed photographing and why.
Oh, without a doubt, early Patti Smith, The Clash. And I've got to say, Surfport, this punk band out of New York, they've just got a wacky energy and such a positive vibe to them. Most of their shows are mayhem, but it's kind of like a roller coaster ride. But Patti Smith and The Clash were just, you know, they came out and they pummeled you and looked good doing it. Patti Smith and the Patti Smith group just had an aura and presence that the 3 times I saw him never lacked for, and was always on spot on and dynamic.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. The majority of this brilliant and beautifully produced book, and we have to talk briefly about Hozak before we let you go, the publishers, is about community. You know, whether it was these boneheads who hated punk rock on the cover, or the many punk rock crowds that are portrayed throughout the book. These are people who cared about the music and cared about each other. And I don't think I've ever seen, Greg, an art book about rock and roll that captures that as well.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. You kind of summed up and observed what hopefully Hozak and I kind of like try to do.
Well, you write this in the book, and I think you told me about it when you first called me, when Todd Novak and Brett Cross, Hozak, in other words, who came from the fanzine world, came to you and said, Marty Perez, we want to do a book with you. You were like, get out.
Yeah, pretty much. And they kept on nagging me and prodding me to the point where there was about a year and a half, year ago? Mm-hmm. Everything kind of was at the right place, right time, and I had the focus and was able to sit down for 3/4 of a year and scan and put everything together and give them to Hozak. And you know, Todd, who's the designer, did, you know, rather than doing 1 photo per page, he really packed it in there, and everything has a rhyme and reason.
Yeah, it tells a story. It really does. It tells a story of 4 decades, Kill a Punk for Rock and Roll, 1976 to 2019, photos by Marty Perez.
Thanks for being in the trenches with us over the decades.
Oh, man.
Really appreciate it. And
we
this
have
is
the
great
bruises
tribute
to show
to that.
It.
Yeah. Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Marty. That's it for our conversation with Marty Perez. His book, Kill a Punk for Rock and Roll, is truly a work of art. As much love devoted to the shots of artists you have never heard of as Jimmy Page. You know, you gotta love it. Let us know what you think, though. Coming up, more of our favorite songs about photography in a minute on Sound Opinions. Remember in 2018 when Border Patrol separated thousands of refugee kids from their parents, deported those parents back to their home countries, and kept the kids in the United States? Believe it or not, 6 years later, there are still hundreds of families who have not yet been reunited.
Though we as a community may feel hopeless at times, we recently learned about an organization called Al Otro Lado, which works to reunify families. They provide holistic legal and humanitarian support to refugees, deportees, and other migrants in the U.S. and Tijuana through a multidisciplinary, client-centered, harm reduction-based practice.
Since 2018, they've reunited over 100 refugee families ripped apart by the zero-tolerance policy of the previous administration. Once reunited, Al Otro Lado helps each family find legal representation, housing, and the counseling they need in order to heal and get back on their feet.
Imagine having your child ripped from your arms and never knowing when you would see them again. We can't let family separations go on. If you're like us and believe that all families belong together, then join us supporting Al Otro Lado and donate today.
You can find the link to donate to Al Otro Lado in the description of this episode, or go to gum.fm/charity and donate today. That's gum.fm/charity.
You can also consider volunteering with the organization, which offers opportunities that are both in-person and virtual. The best way to get involved is by filling out an application on their website, alotrolado.org/volunteer.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
And we're back. We've got more songs about photography to share. I'm up next. Jim, I want to go to the Kinks. When in doubt, always go to a Ray Davis song. You're going to get something of substance about almost any subject on the planet.
It's true. The ace sociologist of rock.
So the album, The Kinks Are the Village Green Preservation Society, has not just one, but two songs devoted to photography. Picture Book is a song I want to play, but there's also a song called People Take Pictures of Each Other. And I think one of the reasons was that the conceit of the album was I'm looking back at what England used to be and still wants to be, but no longer is. It's almost like a fading memory, like a photo in a photo album.
The sun set on that empire.
Exactly. And Picture Book is a deceptively jaunty song. You got Ray playing a 12-string guitar on it, very cheerful arrangement, kind of bouncy. But it's wistful. You know, you listen to the lyrics, and it's an old man looking at a photo album, thinking back to his childhood. When you were just a baby, these days when you were happy, a long time ago. So go the lyrics. And it's a personal perspective about this broader theme that I was talking about. You remember what you were to take your mind off what you are now, what you have become. And that is exactly where a position he finds England in at the same time. So here's a Picture Book from the Kinks on Sound Opinions. That's Picture Book from their classic 1968 album, A Masterpiece. The Kinks are the Village Green Preservation Society.
What an album. Greg, I'm going to go next to Duran Duran. Whenever we talk about Duran Duran on the show, we get all this love on social media. There are three generations of super fans, most of them women. We've had two of our much-loved and respected peers, Annie Zaliski and Lori Majewski, at times on the show talking about this band. which always was a little weird, I thought, because despite the great singles, they had this sort of softcore cheesecake thing happening in their videos.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I'm going to play their breakthrough single, Girls on Film. It's actually the third single they'd released. It was 1981. It's the one that first made it to the top of the charts in the UK and the US. And there was big controversy. It seems almost quaint now, looking back in retrospect, two versions of the video. The daytime version, PG-13, and the nighttime version, which the BBC insisted got a R-13 rating, restricted, 18 and above. You know, semi-nude women. There were often barely dressed women in all the Duran Duran videos.
Yeah.
It's very resonant of a time when,
MTV.
Well, kids were so happy if mom and dad got cable and Cinemax at night would show these, you know, softcore, just gratuitous, like hours of women, you know, sitting around in not much clothing. Anyway, Duran Duran is beloved by a generation despite all that. This, of course, is a signature song, Girls on Film. They're celebrating exactly what the title promises, models being photographed and, all supermodel pretty themselves, them getting to bask in that aura. Gotta love Duran Duran if you're of a certain age, I suppose. The hooks are timeless despite elements being dated. Girls on Film. On her back. Right, Girls on Film by Duran Duran. Where are you going next, Greg?
Jim, I'm going to L.A. in the early 90s. Ice Cube, Who Got the Camera, the name of the song, Question, from the Predator LP in 1992. The song was recorded during the trial of the four police officers who assaulted Rodney King in 1991. And a local witness, a man by the name of George Holliday, happened to videotape the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think the trial would have happened. I don't think there would have been any repercussions if George Holliday had not been on the scene videotaping what the police did on the street. The whole incident triggered the 1992 Los Angeles riots. 53 people killed, 2,000 injured. Military had to be called in. Ice Cube, longtime chronicler of police harassment, going back to his days with NWA and the Straight Outta Compton record, continued that on his solo records. He didn't shrink on throwing some punches when it came to addressing this topic. In the song, Who Got the Camera, he's being roughed up by the police during a traffic stop, and he's basically hoping someone can be his George Holliday and videotape what is going on while the while the police are attacking him. So here's Ice Cube with his take, Who Got the Camera, on Sound Opinions.
Started the investigation, no driver's license, no registration. When I stepped out the car, they slammed me. God damn ya, who got the camera? No lights, no camera, no action. And the pigs wouldn't believe that my slave name is Jackson. He said, don't lie to me. I'm looking for John, Maddie, or Spike Lee.
That is Ice Cube with Who Got the Camera.
Greg, I'm going to stay on the hip-hop tip, and I'm going to cheat a little bit, okay? I'm going to play Hey Ya by Outkast, right? What a fantastic single. Who can't love the spirit of that song and the Hey Ya dance, written by Andre 3000? People forget the actual title after the Hey Ya exclamation point. Mm. There's a parens, Shake It Like a Polaroid Picture.
Right.
And that line only comes up once, you know, exuberantly, like the whole song, Shake It Like a Polaroid Picture. So the reason I'm cheating, not a song about photography, really, a song about fidelity. You know, does she really want to mess around? Can't stand to see me walk out the door? You know, a guy who's going back and forth on, am I going to leave her because she's cheating on me, or am I going to try to salvage this relationship? You know, during the breakdown, they shout, Shake It Like a Polaroid Picture. The reason I love this song, besides it being one of the greatest songs ever, is the Polaroid Corporation launched a campaign putting out information saying, please do not shake your Polaroid film. Because in the earliest days of the instant camera, camera, right? You had to shake it to expedite drawing.
Right.
But they had improved so much, you know, by 2000 or so. This was a 2003 single, that you no longer had to do that. And in fact, it could damage the photograph,
yeah.
You know. And my daughter was really young at the time. I loved taking Polaroid pictures. You know, I just think that, you know, they were so much more fun than digital
absolutely.
Photography.
And,
you know?
They're still, and they're still new, like a new generation is doing it
yes.
to this day.
Like
because
cassette
they
tapes.
Like it. It's yeah. just cool.
It was cool. But kids, do not shake your Polaroid
exactly.
picture.
You
shake
go.
Your whatever else you want to shake, because how can you not shake when you're listening to Outkast, but not the picture.
I want to see y'all on y'all baddest behavior. Lend me some sugar. I am your neighbor. Here we go. Shake it, 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 shake it like a Polaroid picture. Hey, yeah, shake it, 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 sugar, shake it like a Polaroid picture.
I was going to go obvious for this pick, too, you know, and do pictures of Lily by The Who, but problematic aspects talking about that
one.
You
got a good song. One of the greatest songs of the 21st century.
Hey-ya.
You just have to say those two words, and people are right on it. They're doing
everybody.
The dance and everything.
Everybody.
You know? I want to go to Mission of Burma.
Yeah, I was.
This is not a photograph, Jim.
I was upset when I saw you got your list in first, and I'm like, yeah, of course. One of the greatest songs about photography. Well, one of the greatest songs, period, ever.
It gives me an opportunity to talk about surrealism. You know, Roger Miller, in particular, from that band, was a student of surrealist artists, and you know, he's essentially riffing on Magritte, the French surrealist painter, René Magritte.
This is not a pipe.
Who's painting the, you know, yes, exactly. He talks about the treachery of images in this photograph, you know, with a little inscription on the bottom, this is not a pipe. It's a picture of a pipe, but this is not a pipe. So it's sort of a meta commentary, right?
Yes.
And in the same way that this song is a meta commentary on photography. Oblique references to bigotry and breaking the barrier between image and reality. Very, very sparse lyrically.
Yeah.
In a typical Mission of Burma, Roger Miller fashion, not spelling it out for you, making you go, okay, what's going on exactly?
Yeah, what is he doing?
But it's a very cool song. And in typical fashion, the Burma guys dealing with these topics, you know, the surrealism things was real because on this EP, they only got like six songs, that first EP, Signals, Calls, and Marches. And you have this song about a surrealist painter. And then you also have a song named Max Ernst.
Yes.
About another surrealist painter
yes.
from Germany, right? Anyway, here we have This Is Not a Photograph from Mission of Burma on Sound Opinions. This is not a photograph.
This
Jim.
Is not a photograph.
As we talk about photographs.
Oh, my God. All right, last one from me. I'm going to go with The Cure. I am not the biggest Cure fan in the world, and so that's going to offset all the love mail we got for Duran Duran. All the Cure fans are going to write. You know, but they could craft great singles. And, of course, Pictures of You is one of them. Fourth and final single from their eighth studio album, Disintegration, 1989. You know, Robert Smith was always just a bit much for me, okay? But there's a great story behind this song. His house burned down, and he was going through what was left in the ashes and came across his wallet that had pictures of his wife, Mary. They were devoted to each other. The cover of the single was one of those pictures, and it also showed up on the cover, I will say, of Charlotte Sometime, and got him thinking about what photographs mean, you know, and you know, it struck me in my days as a beat reporter covering innumerable fires, you know, how often in natural disasters and fires, people were most upset about the photographs. You know, this is your history being erased. There are things that are replaceable. And then, you know, but those baby pictures, the wedding pictures, those are not. Pictures of You by The Cure.
Pictures of you that I almost believe that the pictures are all I can see.
Pictures of You by The Cure wraps up our show on photography and music, and now we want to hear from you. What is your favorite song about photography? What's your favorite music photograph? Leave a voice message on our website, soundopinions.org. Mr. Cott, what do we have on the show next week?
Jim, next week we're going to have a fascinating conversation with the co-founder of Cranky Records, which was a Chicago-based label whose aesthetic influenced indie rock around the world. No exaggeration in the 90s and 2000s.
Yeah, and, you know, is also a story about that era and how difficult but rewarding it was to run an indie label. And don't forget to check out our bonus podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this program belong solely to Sound Opinions and not necessarily to Columbia College Chicago or our sponsors. Thanks, as always, to our Patreon supporters. Sound Opinions is produced by Andrew Gill, Alex Claiborne, and our associate producer, Sol Delgadillo. Our Columbia College intern is Lauren Holt, and our social media consultant is Katie Cott.